Here's why you need to attend the Recruitment Coach Live Summit in Florida this October. Reason number one is networking. This is an opportunity to connect with like-minded recruitment business owners from across the United States and around the world. We have people coming from all over the states, California, New Jersey, Ohio, Seattle, plus Canada, and even flying over from the UK. By the way, the price is going up as the event gets closer. To get the early bird discount, register now by visiting recruitmentcoach.com/summit. Have a listen to what some of our previous attendees said about their experience of joining us at the live summit.
So this is the third live event that I've been to, and I always feel that I leave with so many ideas and actions to put in place. It's important, I think, to take a couple of days out, even though it feels like it's an impossibility. It makes a huge difference in the long run. But I really enjoy meeting everyone that I have seen on all the Zoom calls throughout the year. And it cements those relationships. So, you know, there's people who you can just like drop a quick message to here and there if you need help with something, or, you know, they've got something that you need, and creates a really valuable community and strengthens those relationships.
To learn more, visit recruitmentcoach.com/summit. Welcome to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Whitby, and today we're joined by Trey Hughley. Trey Hughley is the president of Genesis Resources, based in Dallas-Fort Worth. Trey is a leader in executive search for the insurance industry with over 28 years of experience. Having launched and sold a recruiting firm, Trey founded Genesis Resources in 2004 with a commitment to bring a consultative approach to recruitment. Trey also founded Genesis Industries in 2014, expanding consultancy practices into manufacturing, engineering, accounting and finance, and the healthcare sectors. Trey, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Fantastic. So we know quite a few people in common. The person who specifically referred you is Chris Danasso, who has been on the show before. I believe you guys are both part of, is it NIRA, National
Insurance? Yeah, National NIRA. Insurance Recruiting Association.
Okay. There's some great folks in that organization. Yeah, I'm assuming you know Gail Audibert.
Yeah.
Gerald LaGrove. Do you know Gerald?
I know Toronto. Yeah.
So Gail and Gerald
really
are
great
both
people.
Yeah, absolutely. High quality people in this association that you've got. Gail and Gerald are part of our coaching program, and Gail's such a wonderful advocate for us, both within the Pinnacle Society, which she's a member of, as well as within NIRA and other organizations. So I'm glad that we got introduced. So how did you get into recruiting in the first place, Trey?
Probably like everyone else in recruiting, stumbled into it right out of college. You know, you don't go to college and say, I'm going to be a recruiter.
Actually, some people do. More recently, like in our day, that didn't happen. But I think nowadays, especially if you look online at like, what are the top paying jobs that you can get like without a degree in law or medicine or something, and recruiting is in the top 10. And people look at these things and they go, hey, that sounds pretty cool. I'd like to try that. But that's a relatively new thing, I think.
I think so. Well, and I think it's great because, during my interview to get into recruiting, the owner of the company was really funny because I had all these other offers to do all the normal stuff coming out of college. And he goes, all right, I'm going to pay you about a third of what all these other people are going to pay you. But, you know, in 5 years, when you're sitting next to the guy next to you and he's had 7 years of experience and the other person sitting on your left's got 8 years of experience, regardless of what you do, you're always going to make less than them. You can work twice as hard. You can do everything you can. But in normal, you know, corporate America, you know, everybody takes those stair steps. You get your COLA increase or whatever have you. So unless you change titles or you become a leader in something, you're never going to make any more than those folks. He goes, here, you could be sitting next to somebody that's 5 years in the business, and if you outperform them, you're going to make more money than them. And, you know, the whole concept of that, like, you know, today's the day after the 4th of July for us. That was fireworks in my head, right? I was like, oh man, meritocracy, that's amazing. I'm in, you know, where do I sign? So that's how I got into it.
Yeah. So I agree 100%. That was what appealed to me when I first got into recruiting as well, is the idea that you could write your own paycheck. And, you know, that it was based on your own performance rather than somebody else telling you what they think you should make. So I totally get that. And then how did things go from there?
It was great. About a year and a half, maybe 2 years into it, one of the senior partners came to me and said, hey, what do you think about starting our own specialty company? Because back then there weren't a whole lot of firms that just specialized in one industry. And I was already doing quite a bit for the insurance sector at our boutique firm. And I was like, yeah, sure. Why not? You know, we just had twins, you know, I've barely making any money. Why not go start a company? This is a great idea. So, you know, I tend to do things with both feet, jump in, don't really look at how shallow the water is sometimes. But anyway, we started another company. So we started a company that was focused strictly on the insurance industry. And it actually doing that back then was a big deal because there really wasn't a whole lot of internet. There wasn't a lot of social media there. So being able to say that, you know, we really understood the industry and we were going to be their right arm in the market, was really powerful. You know, it's still nice today because we still specialize in that market. Back then it was a huge deal. So it was a nice marketing campaign. And then in, 2003, my partner and I just kind of, you know, I guess, just disagreement of, which direction the company was going in. And I wanted to do a lot more, consulting and executive search, that sort of thing. Which requires a lot different agreement, a lot different search level, just more, support and so forth. She wanted to go in a little different direction. And, so I sold my ownership to her and started, Genesis in 2004.
Ah, okay.
We were an executive search firm only for a couple of years. That's all we did. And a couple of years into it, I started getting calls from all the leaders we were placing and they said, hey, we need you to come back and do that on the contingency side and the professional level. And so we started doing that. My big thing was, is I wanted to be a little different. So, we took a little more of an executive approach to contingency work. So because we had these strong relationships, I didn't feel uncomfortable doing contingency because I felt like if I did it right, we were still going to make money on those searches or we were still going to be successful rather than a lot of, a lot of retained firms don't do contingency because they want that commitment. And I felt like we had that already. And so that's how we moved into the professional search side.
It makes sense. I agree. Like the commitment is the key, right? And usually getting the retainer or the engagement fee is the sign that that client this is a mutually committed search, right? And so they're serious about this and they're going to work in partnership with you. I know from our previous conversation, having a partnership approach is, you know, something that you believe in as well. And so I think you can potentially achieve that in contingency if the conditions for success are present. So it sounds like you already had the relationship and you had the commitment. So it wasn't as big a deal to forego the retainer fee. But I guess to me, I don't know how this strikes you, Trey. The minimum for me is exclusive. I want to, even if there's no deposit, I want to partner exclusively with that company because otherwise you can do everything right and things can still, you know, not go in your favor. But what's your thoughts on that?
I think I'm, I agree with that, but it doesn't necessarily have to be an I think exclusivity is the goal, right? It's kind of like, running a business or anything else, right? You've got to have a plan. You've got to be able to look ahead and you continue to run towards that target. You know, it's like sailing towards the horizon, right? As long as you're heading in the right direction and you know which direction you're going in, you don't have to get there tomorrow. So with an exclusive arrangement, absolutely, you know, love those and you have to build those relationships to get there. What happens if you don't have that relationship, right? And that's the challenge, right? Is, well, do I force the retainer and maybe not have as much business? Or do I find a way to show this company what an exclusivity looks like or what a retainer looks like? And, you know, that's part of it, right? Is a lot of, in my mind, a lot of recruiters and even, you know, a lot of clients see retainers as just upfront fees. When I do a retainer, it's not just upfront fees. You're getting personality profiling. You're getting all kinds of not only reference checks, but industry references. You're getting marketplace data. We're going to do salary surveys for you. There's a lot of things that come with a retainer that you don't do with contingency. And so we continue to sell the retainer, but only when it's needed, right? It's kind of like asking someone to, you know, pay for a custom suit when they're only going to use it twice a year and you go to Men's Warehouse, right? I mean, it's, and I'm not knocking Men's Warehouse. They got some great suits, but it's the difference between a $600-$700 suit and a $3,000 suit. And why spend that kind of money if you're only going to wear it twice? I kind of look at the retainer the same way. Is it better, you know, it better really fit. It better be something we're going to use. We're going to understand it and really appreciate it from a hiring manager's perspective. So, you know, but again, back to your point, yes, love exclusives. We target that. We also have a scale here with our, with each client where, we categorize them and we make sure that, our recruiters here, and the staff here, understand that this is an exclusive versus a non-exclusive. And if it's a non-exclusive, what are we doing to make it an exclusive, right? We understand it's not an exclusive. We understand. I love competition because here's the thing with competition. You can't be first place unless you have competition. There's got to be someone in second. So how can you claim that you're the best if you don't have competition? So I'm okay with competition because it just makes me, you know, iron sharpens iron, right? It makes me better. A lot of times there's things competitions do. I mean, I'd say half the stuff that we do, we learn because we got beat at something. So so I actually enjoy that piece of it. It's just a matter of how do you ask the questions with your hiring managers? How much do you trust each other? Are they going to send you on a wild goose chase? That's another, you know, fear of recruiters, right? Is they've already kind of got the person they're going to hire. They're just not telling me that. So, and they want to waste my time so that they've got all this, I call it candidate fodder, right? They've got all this bench, you know, group of people or bench talent that they can throw at their executive or their hiring manager to, justify their own hire. Hey, we can go hire one of these guys, but it's going to cost you $30,000 or just hire the guy that I've already found, right?
Candidate fodder. That's a good, I've not heard that term before. That resonates. So I love the idea, as you say, of grading your jobs so that people know, you know, what they're in for and how this compares to the other things that they're currently working on. And we have a similar instrument with our clients, job order scorecard that we get them to use with their teams to make sure they're working on the right things and they're spending the right amount of time on those things. But let me, you're saying you like competition. I disagree, Trey. Let me play devil's advocate for a second, because let me give you an example. I know already from our conversation and from the prep work that you sent me and everything that you believe in doing things like you're consultative, you're working in partnership, you're working in a very high quality way. Not all agencies work that way, right? So let's say that you are in competition with another firm. You're doing things properly, like, for example, speaking to candidates and pre-qualifying them and getting them, make sure they're interested before you submit their resume, right? But maybe your competitor around the corner is just going to find their, you know, profile on LinkedIn or their resume online, and they're going to send it before they've even spoken to the candidate, right? Now, you then go to the client and say, hey, I found someone really good. Susan McDonald, she's got this, and this experience. She's perfect for the job. When would you like to see her? And the client says, sorry, Trey, I've already got this resume from your competitor. That, to me, that seems broken, right? Because
it's completely
you've done
broken.
It properly. And the person who cuts corners gets the fee.
That happens to us. It happens to us. I wouldn't say a lot, but it does happen to us. But I would say out of the times that it happens to us, there's about an 80% chance that our client still gives us credit for it. And so that's the relationship building part, right? You have to understand what kind of, you know, you have to understand what the color of the sandbox you're getting into, right? So you need to understand like, what kind of sandbox am I getting into? How many predators are out there, so to speak, right? How many competitors are out there? And there's competitors and there's predators, right? The predators are the ones you're talking about that don't do any work. And we have a couple of competitors out there that do that. But I'll give you an idea. So in our market, they just had one of the companies just had a major layoff in one of their divisions. And so, our client actually called us and said, hey, you know, don't send us anyone from there. We want to go after it ourselves. I was like, well, okay, it's not really a partnership. I said, why don't we get a little creative with this? If you really want to go after those individuals, and it really their market doesn't match exactly what they're after, so it's going to be a little bit of a filtering process anyway. I said, why don't you do this? Instead of paying us whatever normal fees you pay us, why don't we drop that? Why don't we do a project fee? Why don't you just pay us once for however many hires you want to have. And we'll go through that candidate, the candidate pool with you and help you evaluate and figure out which ones are going to be best. But here's the thing that you're running into is if you don't utilize a recruiter, all of those individuals, you know, our clients, not necessarily the biggest and most well-known company out there. So that's who all of the candidates are interviewing with right now. They're all interviewing with those other companies. And I, you know, the whole point with my clients, let us help you get the word out. Let us help you explain who you are to these individuals, because some of them would really fit better in your organization than they would in some of these bigger ones. And the only way to get to them, the only way to explain it is to use a firm like ours. And they loved it. And they're like, okay, you know what? You have a really great point. They said, you know, there's a couple of other recruiters just recently sent us a couple of resumes from there. And what we're going to do is we're going to let those recruiters know that that company is hands off. We don't want to see a single resume from that organization, because we're going to utilize you strictly for identifying, recruiting, and evaluating those individuals. So that for me is a real partnership, right? And what's interesting is they haven't heard from these other two recruiting firms in 6 months on some of their openings, but all of a sudden everybody's getting laid off and they're throwing people at them. Kind of like you said, right? The predator approach. I'm going to go grab it and throw it and see what happens. And we were able to have that conversation and we're able to do that for them because of our relationship.
That's a brilliant idea. I love that solution. You know, the client's got a problem and you're coming up with a creative solution that works for both of you. So that makes total sense, Trey. I think, as you say, it's about the relationship. And I guess I said my minimum is exclusive, but I guess there's one level below that, which is that you have agreed the ground rules of here's what we're going to do for you and here's what we need from you in return. So an example of that, one of those rules of engagement could be, look, we're going to be very thorough in, you know, vetting candidates, making sure we're not wasting your time. We're only sending you candidates who not only have the right experience that you're looking for, but they're also interested and, you know, willing to move forward to an interview. And what we need from you in return is if we shortlist an individual, then it means that that candidate has agreed to be represented by us, and we would expect you to interview those candidates through us, regardless of whether anyone else has chucked the resume at you. Fair, right? And so you almost pre-sell it up front, the, you know, worst case scenario, and get them to agree that that is a fair way of proceeding. But I love your project fee approach too. That's a cool idea.
Instead of them doing an upfront fee, it was, why don't we do this? Why don't we do a per hire flat fee, since you're going to hire multiple people? So, you know, and we get creative with some of those things. Back to your point about the candidate side, and I really actually call them customers, not candidates. Because I feel like there's two different customers in this market. There's the ones that are paying and there's the ones we work with, right? Candidates really defines a group of people that we own. And we're a means to an end. You know, at the end of the day, we're a consulting firm. We're a talent agency. We don't hire them. You know, we don't fire them. You know, we don't do any of that. So they're still a customer. If we don't treat them like a customer, they're not going to call us. But we tell our clients this too, is, you know, all the companies, hiring managers, we require an email from that individual saying, I understand you're submitting me to XYZ. You know, thank you, blah, blah, blah. So we require that from every individual. So, you know, they understand where their information's going at all times. The other piece on the exclusivity part is if my client is they're in urgent mode, right? Oh my God, we've got to have a hire in the next 60 days. I'll go, look, here's the three companies I can't recruit out of for this role. Let me talk to you about my clients that kind of where they'd have people that would fit this role. Here are the three companies I'm not going to be able to touch because we honor all of our agreements. Call whatever tier two firm you have, whatever recruiting firm that you also use, and tell them you only want to see candidates from these firms. And then that way it's a semi-exclusive, but I'm also being honest and upfront and having this open dialogue with our clients that allows them to solve their problem, because they might hire. So here's, you know, it's a win-win for everyone because they're going to get their position filled and it may not be through us, right? But one of my clients is probably going to have that opening and call me if they need it. Right. If one of their people decides that, you know, it's time to leave, and, you know, we try to partner with a lot of really great companies, but, you know, everybody's got an opportunity that's better than the one they're in. And if they find it, they're going to leave. So our hope is that, you know, that client's going to call us, and the search we just did pivots to wherever that individual came from. So there's some opportunity there as well.
Trey, this is genius. I've never heard of this approach before. It's a really creative way of handling off-limits companies where you're right. If one of your competitors is successful in recruiting from those companies, it's going to create an opening for you anyway, but it also protects your, you know, from an integrity point of view, you can't recruit from those client companies. So that's a brilliant way of handling that situation. Trey, do you know what I'd love to dive into is building a business, because this is something that like very few recruiting firms get to the sort of size. How many people do you have? 15 or 20?
27.
27 people. Okay. So like already you're in like, I don't know, 5% of recruiting firms at that size, maybe less than that. Very few are successful in building an organization that operates, you know, and the way that you have it set up, I know that you're really proud of the team that you've built and the fact that you've got leaders within your business who have come up, you know, been promoted right out of college or early in their career. Talk to me about how that progressed from just you starting this business to now you have 27 people. Hey, resilient recruiters, I hope you can tell by now, I love the recruitment industry, and I'm working really hard to produce excellent content and give you value. Having been a recruiter myself, I know how rewarding it can be. I also know how tough it can be. I'm on a mission to reach as many recruiters as possible and have a positive impact on their careers and their businesses. If I can help you make more placements, that means you're improving more lives, and together we can have a real positive impact on the world. The biggest thing you can do to support me on this mission is please take a couple of minutes and leave me a review. Then send an email or LinkedIn message to let me know so I can thank you personally.
It's tough. I can tell you along the way. It's funny because my wife and I'll talk about this, and other friends that are not in the industry will talk about it. And I could have made a lot more money over the last 15 years if I was just doing it on my own. Mine's an end game, right? If I build it, it's I think my mentality is a little different. I enjoy the concept of building. I like the idea of growing something and the whole giving back part. When I graduated, the thing I left out, when I graduated college, my actual job I was going to do was English as a second language, because at the time I could speak fluent Spanish. That was the easiest way to get into a school and be a coach at the same time. So I've always had kind of that coaching mentality where I wanted to, you know, I wanted to coach baseball and I wanted to do, teach English and history. Because I truly believe that your best teachers, your best coaches are salespeople, right? It's not a top-down approach. It's, I want to play for that person because they're amazing, right? Because they love the sport. They love the lessons, all of the information they're providing. Say the same thing about pastors, right? Your best pastors are usually the ones that are good salespeople. And it's not that they're forcing you to buy something, right? They're just so good at it that you want to buy, right? You want to learn, you want to play. And so for me, that was a big deal in building the company was, there was a lot of deals I didn't take commission on. And there were a lot of, with a lot of my clients now, I have other people, other leaders that claim them kind of, you know, for lack of a better term, claim them as their clients. And that's one of the, kind of the misnomers that I get into with some individual, and 2 to 3 man shop practitioners is they always want that commission off their full deal. And I gave that up at an early age and said that's my investment in my future. Right. So by giving that up and allowing other people to capitalize on it and showing them what we need to do as a consulting firm, how we need to treat both, you know, all of our customers, right? Both individuals and hiring managers and talent acquisition and everybody else, that ultimately will lead to a much longer term and successful organization.
100%. I subscribe to that as well. I'm not as far in the journey as you, but I'm definitely building a team and I want to build a machine, right? That works without me being, you know, involved in everything. And that's the first thing. And recently I've been able to actually take vacations for the first time in, you know, 20 plus years, which is incredible to actually relax and know that your clients are getting looked after, the business is still making money, and you know your team have got it under control. So that's been amazing. But also, it's fun. It's more, I know everyone's different and there are some lone wolves who just, they don't want to, you know, have the bother of working with other people, but I've tried it both ways and I'm having a lot more fun now because I have colleagues and people who are driving different parts of the business and we're accomplishing so much more than I ever could have on my own. So I admire what you're doing, Trey, and I'm on that same journey.
It's so rewarding. I mean, everybody feels, and again, back to your point about, you know, I feel like we've got the staff and the foundation now, and I've been through a couple of people who I thought were going to be future leaders in the company, and they ultimately hit the eject button for another industry or something like, and I still work with one of them. He's a great guy, and I really thought he was going to be one of the leaders in our company, but he moved over to the insurance industry. He had to do it, and you know, he's doing fantastic, and I keep in touch with him. I think it's amazing. You know, we may or may not work with them at some point, but to be able to see these individuals grow their careers and take care of their families and, you know, have a one income family and still be successful so that they've got this, you know, nucleus, or, you know, even the ones that have two income families, but they're just that much wealthier. And have, like you said, have time, right? They can work, you know, 8 to noon on a Friday and it's not a problem, right? I love that. I love being able to see that.
Definitely. So can you walk me through what were the kind of key milestones or stages in that journey?
We've been around for 20, that's what I'm wearing my 20th year. We've been around for 20 years as of April, but,
Oh, congrats. That's
so
amazing.
Yeah. So, we just passed that. And, I created a little bit of a, you know, call it mad scientist in the back room, profile, cause you know, everybody's profile is different. You know, if you do the DISC profiles, you want a high, you know, high D, a little higher I and all these other things. And, my profile actually was competition. I needed to see people that were competitors. And in a lot of cases, athletes. We have a lot of athletes here. It's not that you have to be a previous athlete to be a good recruiter. Just here, it works. And there's several people here that are successful that weren't athletes previously. I'm just saying it's, for us, it's a less miss option, right? So the idea, and it's specific to team sports. Because an individual, you know, again, lone wolf, right? But in the team sport, you can work as hard as possible. You can do everything you tried and you still lost, right? If you think about baseball, it's a great analogy because, you know, the shortstop could be the stud on the team. He's got this huge batting average. He's hitting balls out of the park, but they can still lose, you know, 13 to 11, you know, 1-0, right? They're still counting on the pitcher and the catcher and everybody else to come in and do their job. So that, and that's very synonymous with recruiting. You can do everything possible. And at the last minute, the candidate takes a counteroffer, right? You've done everything you can. And at the end of the day, somebody's parent or spouse or child says, you're going to go work for that company. And they leave, right? And you don't even know why, right? There's those kinds of things that happen and you have to be able to bounce back from that. You have to be able to learn from it, right? And so that's, you know, that's part of that kind of team competitive spirit, right? It goes back to when you talk about exclusivity and non-exclusivity. I love the competition. I thrive on it, right? I love the fact that the previous company I sold, they're still probably one of my biggest competitors in the market. I know the owner over there is a great guy, and he's part of NYRA, and you know, we talk a couple times a year, and you know, several of my previous employees that I trained when I was in that company are still there and really successful. So I love the idea that there's competition out there. And again, that just goes back to my athletic background.
Awesome. Yeah, no, I love the analogy with competitive sports. And actually, that's something that we talk about in our program is, you know, what's the profile of the sort of person that you should hire? And my friend, Joel Slenning, who's been on the podcast before, he absolutely looks for athletes for that reason. It's the competitiveness, and someone who's coachable, right? Someone who is striving to improve constantly. And yeah, there's a lot of crossover for sure. So how did you go from 1 to 2 and then 2 to 5 and 5 to 10 and 10 to 27? Like, what was the process?
It's kind of a train the trainer mentality, right? So I'll tell you the guy that my right hand right now is a guy named Ryan, and he came in. He was at DBU working for their baseball program. He was a baseball player at Dallas Baptist, and
he came over and really first couple of years, just a recruiter, right? And then what I started doing was one of the clients I had was bringing in a lot of business. I said, hey, sit on the calls with me. I mean, so it is a long process, right? So he's been with me now for, it's over 10 years. I mean, he's been with me for a while. But you know, the first three were really challenging, right? Because he needed to try to get up to speed and trained. And some of it's, you know, on the job, some of it's classroom, right? And it's bouncing back and forth. And then, you know, he's brought on a couple of people that were really good at what they do. And, he actually, one of the guys that's probably one of our best performers is a former childhood friend of his that actually rode an hour. So he commuted an hour each way to the office. This is, back before COVID. And, they talked about recruiting for an hour each way. And they talk about the desk and how it works. So he had kind of his own built-in hour training every day with this guy.
2 hours of extra training every day.
It was cool. It was cool to listen to. And I wasn't involved in that at all, which made it even better. And I think that's a big piece of it is when you go from one to two and then two to five and so forth, you can't push it. I've tried to push. I mean, I've made my mistakes. Don't get me wrong. This has not been just, you know, success whirlwind, you know, 101, right? And a lot of my challenges were pushing people and trying to get them to be somebody they weren't. And I've spent too much time in a lot of cases believing in them more than they believed in themselves. So it's understanding, you know, and being honest with yourself. And I'm, you know, my problem is I'm a giver. I love giving. I love contributing to not only the company, but the people here and their families. And so I'm a big fan of giving back. And the problem with that, you know, if you're a giver, is that you tend to fool yourself with people. And you'll see more than they see in themselves, and they'll never see that. And if you're not careful, you'll spend way too much time on them, way too much energy. And then when you do decide to let them go, or they decide to leave, either way, you wind up, if you're not careful, you wind up blaming them. It wasn't their fault. It was yours, or it was mine, right? And so taking ownership of that, once I started doing that and taking ownership of my mistakes, I was a much better at leading, because I could figure out much quicker who was going to work, who wasn't going to work, and who I could spend my time with.
Trey, this is brilliant. And it's so interesting, because being a successful recruiter, it's all about taking ownership for whatever happens, right? Whether it's a success or you don't make the placement or they take a counter offer, whatever. It's not your fault, but it is your responsibility, right? And you need to own that and learn from it. But then that applies to leadership as well. So a lot of times I hear owners and managers, you know, real frustrated with, you know, people who aren't performing or what have you. But you nailed it when you said, like, that's up to me, right? Like, either I hired the wrong person, which was my decision, or I didn't give them enough training, which again, so that points back to me, or I'm not, you know, there's something, you know, either they're the wrong person, or if they're the right person, but they've not had the right training or the right support and management, it's got to be one of those three things, right? There's no other possibility, but those are all fall within your responsibility as the leader. But it's still tough, right? Like, how do you mentioned this, like, you're a giver and you see, you believe in people more than they believe in themselves. So, how do you decide when it's time to part ways or whether someone could turn around?
Well, that's tough. I had one guy that I fired three times. He talked himself out of it twice and back into the job. So, yeah, I may not be the greatest guy to ask at this, but, you know, he was great. He was great in the moment, but, horrible at execution once you, turned your back. So there's going to be people that fool us. I just, at the end of the day, it's, you know, who can I put my faith in? Who can I trust? And are they meeting their metrics? And I think that's the biggest piece, right? You know, I go back to the baseball analogy, but, you look at Moneyball, right?
Yeah. That was a great film.
The one metric, what was the one metric, right? You can't score if you're not on base.
Right. Getting on
base. We want people who can actually get on base. I don't care how they do it. Just get on base. Right. And for us, it's metrics. If you're not meeting your metrics, and they're simple metrics, I always, if I can back up for a minute, one of the things I always tell everyone here is you are your own business leader, right? Treat me as your private equity. Your desk is a business. And if you're, you know, think about your salary, think about your commissions, because we pay everybody a nice base salary. Everybody here is a W-2. So it's a big nut every month. I want to be competitive with, you know, with my clients. I want to beat my clients out for top talent. Right. So we pay a competitive salary, and then our bonus program is strong enough that where, if people who are performing, they're still making, you know, 50%+ of whatever they're doing. It just takes a little while to get there. Which in my mind is competitive in the recruiting industry, but it also signifies the concept of, if you're making 50% of what you produce, what's the other 50% paying for at your desk, right? And are you generating a profit or a loss? And so, and here are the metrics by which you achieve that, right? So you have to have at least 5 conversations a day with the candidate or customer base. You have to have at least 1 marketing presentation a day, 1 conversation with somebody about their hiring practices, what they're doing, how they're doing it, so forth. And out of those 5 candidate conversations, you should have at least 1 person interested in some opportunity, right? And, you know, my biggest frustration with recruiters is they call individuals and say, hey, I got this amazing job for you. I got this fantastic job and you should consider this job. And who are we to tell them that, right? We're interrupting their day, whether it's middle of the day, maybe it's they're driving on their way to a date at night, whatever it is, right? We're interrupting them and we're telling them about this amazing job and we have no idea who this person is. Why would you do that? I mean, would you take that call? Hey, I've got this a great job, right? And you're like, okay, well, what is it? Well, it's underwater basket weaving in the middle of the Sahara Desert. How is that a great job? What are you talking about, right? But you know, you call someone in the Sahara, they may think it's amazing. But my point in all that is that we're interrupting people's days, and for a good reason. But we can't tell them that we know them and that we understand who they are and what makes them up and what wakes them up every morning and gets them energized about, you know, going to bed before the next day, until we get to know them. And so that, when I say it's one submission, it's one individual interested in working with you. So they've got to be able, you know, out of those 5 conversations, you got to be good enough on the phone to be able to have that conversation, to have enough empathy, to have enough intuition, to really make strong communication skills, to make a connection enough to say, yeah, you know what? I'd be willing, if there was the right opportunity, I'd be willing to work with you. What are you currently representing? What kind of jobs do you represent in the future? What kind of things, you know, can you call me back about, right? If you're doing the 5, and I call them 511s. If you're doing the 511s, and honestly, that's a mediocre successful recruiter. That's someone who's billing probably 200K a year. Someone who's billing 500K a year is doing 721s, right? They're doing 7 conversations a day. They're making 2 marketing conversations a day, and they're getting, again, out of those 7, they're still getting at least 1 person interested in working with them. But those are the people that are billing more, in my mind.
I was going to say the 511 sounds low, like as a kind of benchmark for the metrics. But when you put it like that, that's the minimum. And, you know, obviously we want people to smash that. And it is going to mean that if they want to make more, they need to exceed those minimums. So,
well, it's funny. You were talking to, and I apologize. You were talking to, at some point I was listening to you and Danny Cahill, and he was talking about the phone, right? And how, you know, how it's just, you know, people look at the phone and go, what, I'm supposed to use that, right? I'm supposed to be on the phone. And so that's why it is lower, because a lot of our initial the 5 should be much more filtered, stronger, for lack of a better term, because they're actually on the phone willing to talk to you, right? So you're the initial, you know, when we were, at least when, yeah, and you probably too, when we were coming up, it was, you got to have 100 calls a day. You got to have at least 10 conversations. You know, it's all these massive metrics, but it was because we had no way to set those up, right? Now we have LinkedIn, we have texting, we have email, we have all these campaigns, and those are all, that's all noise in my mind, right? So I don't, you know, whatever those numbers are numbers, and you can eventually boil those down, but in my mind, that's white noise. The real information, the real actual conversations are when you actually get someone on the phone.
Okay. No, that makes a lot of sense. There's other work going on behind the scenes in order to set up those 5 or 7, you know, candidate conversations and 1 or 2 client conversations per day. So yeah, that makes total sense. So zooming back out then to the overall question. So obviously hitting their metrics is one way to evaluate, you know, whether someone is going to make it or not. What else are you looking at or taking into consideration?
Well, I mean, obviously income, right? If they're not generating revenue, they're losing business, right? So that's a big piece of it. And I think the more you focus on easy numbers, mm-hmm. you know, if you're not producing at least $20,000 a month, you know, that's kind of table stakes in my mind in recruiting, right?
Okay.
You got to be at least producing 20 grand a month, which is $240,000 a year. Yeah. That's only $250,000. You want to be a $1 million producer. So it's table stakes, right? And so if you're not doing that, then you have to start peeling the onion back, right? So are you making at least two placements a month? You know, or are you making one placement a month? Cause that's that 20,000, right? Yeah. How much do you have in what we call as pendings, right? So how much business do you have pending possible offers? Anything in a second interview plus is a pending for us. And our metrics show that about 53% of pendings close. So if you don't have at least $40,000 to $50,000 in pendings every month, mm-hmm. you're never going to reach your $20,000 to $25,000 a month, right?
Right.
So then, you know, then you.
So that, can I just understand?
Yeah, go ahead.
Pendings is basically the pipeline based Correct. On interview activity. So you can predict what's going to close or whatever.
Right. And every second plus interview requires two first interviews, two hiring manager interviews, right? So on our metrics, for every two first interviews, you get one second plus interview. If someone's on a second plus interview, they're pending. So then you just back that. And the only way we mark it as pending is as long as we understand it's a final interview, right? So second plus, that's why there's a plus next to it, is you could have second plus and it leads to a third or a fourth until it's a final, right? But once it's a final interview, it's pending. But most of our second plus interviews are pendings, or second interviews are pendings. And then, you know, so you need two first interviews for that. You need at least, you know, to present four people to just get a first interview, right? Now, we boil it down. It's really two or three for us, but just in general metrics, because we also have a engineering division, a manufacturing division. And so those metrics start to get messed up depending on what level and what type of business you're recruiting for. So I don't want anybody watching this and going, this has to be my metrics, right? I think it's it needs to be evaluated, right? Based on, like, if you're engineering, you found a really great person, and it's not, the interview is not really about personality. It's about, can they do the job? And if you know they can do the job, that first interview might be a pending, right? Because you know that there's not many aerospace engineers out there. There's not that many specific type of civil engineers out there. And so if they're really good at what they do, they're going to interview and pend. And then, you know, and then you back it up from there. If you're getting those, but you're not getting enough submissions, you know, and then are you making enough phone calls to get those submissions, right? And so that's where that 511 comes in. So if you're doing the 511s minimally, and you're not getting all the way to 50,000 a month in pendings, there's something broken in the process, right, along the way. And that's where the training opportunities exist. So that's where we start looking at, what are the training opportunities? I can't train. We call it space. So our key indicators for how we judge activity every day is, you know, sales, problem solving, sales, problem solving, aggressiveness, communication, and entrepreneurship. It actually spells out space, because we always talk about, you know, hey, we're building a rocket ship here. We want to go fast. How do we grow fast? How do we succeed? I don't want to be a $200,000 producer. I want to be a $1 million producer. How do we get there, and how do we get there fast? Right. So space is all of those things, right? And we've got it everywhere in the office, and it reminds everyone of what they need daily in order to be successful. And so those are the training opportunities, is where within space do we need to train, right? I can't train aggressiveness. Aggressiveness is the 511. If you're not doing that, you know, we're done. Thanks for playing. Let's, we're going to find you a new career. We call it a career transition, is what we call it. We're going to transition you. If you can't succeed here, we don't think you're going to be able to succeed in recruiting. And I've seen people leave here and go try to be other recruiters, other places. I haven't seen anyone leave here and be a successful agency recruiter. And it's just because, and it's not because we're that great. It's just, we probably hired enough people that didn't have that 511 mentality, and they've left. And if you don't have it, you're not going to be a good recruiter anywhere. It doesn't matter. So we give a lot of latitude and a lot of leeway for people, because we need them to get there. So that first month when we bring them on, it's really about training in the industry. The second month is about Can you get to the 511s? And the third month is, are you translating your 511s to actual, you know, actual business, right? And so those are our kind of our 90-day trial period when we bring people on. And if they can't, you know, within 60 days, if they're not doing the 511s, if they're not just picking up the phone and doing the grunt work is what I call it, then there's no reason to keep them. And so, you know, and we'll see people dip like that. And they, you know, they go up and down, and it's because it's, you know, it's, this is hard work. This isn't easy.
Yes,
and,
sir.
And I was talking, you know, Ryan and I were talking the other day, cause we were talking about, you know, the summer coming up and, kids being out of school and so forth. And I thought about it for a minute. It was really interesting. That, you know, we're constantly running a race every day. Like think about, you know, from recruiting Monday through Friday, we're sprinting. Like if you're a successful recruiter, you're sprinting every day, 5 days a week, sometimes six, right? Well, in any race, any school year, any sport, right? You know, all these high performing athletes that make a ton of money, they all have breaks, right? They all have they do stretching, you know, midweek. They do, they're not in the game every day, right? They're doing other things. We don't do that in recruiting. We don't have those breaks. And so it's one of the things we were talking about is how do we help people start developing those breaks, right? And because right now you'll see it and owners get really upset. I've talked to a bunch of them where, you know, this person's doing really great and then they drop off, right? And they even drop off worse. And what they're doing is they're taking a break. So if we can start, and we started talking to a lot of our recruiters about this, if we can start figuring out ways to plug that break in realistically, rather than it sneaking up on you. But if we can start planning those breaks ahead of time, it gives people the ability to really sprint right up to it and then truly take that, you know, refill their energy bank. We talk about it with body, you know, I'm wearing a Garmin watch and it has my body battery on it, right?
It's got the same.
Yeah. I
same
love
one.
It. Yeah. I love it. Yeah. I'm a walking ad for Garmin. It's great. Anybody needs to know about Garmin watch, call me. It's amazing. But, my point in all that is it has body battery here, you know? So we're always talking about how do you refill or recharge in recruiting? We're never doing it. We're trying to sprint a marathon.
This is brilliant, Trey. I like this idea of planning your breaks rather than it creeping up on you. So what does that look like in practical terms? Does that just mean you have a vacation like planned ahead so that you know, like, I'm just going to absolutely go full out sprint because I know that I've got that vacation coming up and I'm going to have some downtime? Or
I think, you know, so part of what we've built around is, and that's the whole idea of scaling. And so I'm taking a little pivot here from the vacation concept for a minute because that's kind of the most obvious. What we've done is we've introduced the idea of building a foundation so that you don't have to be sprinting every day. You have sprinters working with you and for you. So the idea is that if you can build enough of a client base, I'll help you hire and train individuals that work for you. And then what you do is you work with your client, but you're maybe not having to sprint all day long. You're doing other things, right? You're mentoring, you're developing, you're nurturing your client. You're going to see your client, right? You're doing other things than just, you know, I'll use Danny's term. So I've got to give him credit for this, but it's not just want to buy a chicken every day, right? You want to buy a chicken. You want to buy, oh God, I finally found someone. They want to buy a chicken. It's an old script he did. It was hilarious. But my point in all that is that you can only do that for so long without being exhausted. So whether it's for a year, 3 years, 5 years, whatever it is, if you've got something in sight, right? If you've got something ahead of you that you can look forward to, you're willing to do that sprint, even if it's for a couple of years, because you know, as an organization, I say you, you know, the people here know that if they have enough clients, they're going to have other people helping them on a lot of those searches, and that's what's going to make them money.
You've heard of the concept of having a mastermind group, right? This concept was popularized by Napoleon Hill, the author of Think and Grow Rich. It was based on his interviews with people like Andrew Carnegie and Thomas Edison. The purpose of a mastermind group is to meet with a small group of like-minded people to support, encourage, and learn from each other's experience and share knowledge to accelerate the attainment of your goals. If that concept makes sense to you, then join us at the Recruitment Coach Live Summit in Florida on 9th and 10th of October. You'll have multiple opportunities to learn from other successful business owners during breakout sessions and the roundtable discussions. For full information and to register, visit recruitmentcoach.com/summit. I'm glad that it's interesting the direction of this conversation, because I want to ask you about developing managers and leaders in your business. And it seems like we've naturally kind of ended up on that. I do think this business, because it's hard and relentless, and once you've been doing it for, let's say, 3 years plus, it becomes a little bit like Groundhog Day, right? Because you're like, I've had the same conversation about 5,000 times now. And that can lead to burnout, right? If it's not fresh and you're not being challenged in new ways. Now, there's always the challenge of performing at your best, right? That's a continuous challenge. But in terms of the actual skills of the job, if you're not finding new challenges, then that can lead to burnout. Whereas if you are progressing and you're building, you use the analogy of like your desk is a business, right? So if you're not growing your business and then bringing in other people, and then that gives you, yeah, you still have to bill, you still need to, you know, produce clients, et cetera, but it gives you a different dimension to your role. It's not one dimensional anymore. You now have the role of mentor, of coach, of trainer, of manager, and that keeps things fresh. And that can be another way of, you know, avoiding burnout and constantly continuing to enjoy, you know, what you're doing, because it just adds that other dimension. So I'm interested, actually, before I ask about leadership development, what is the model here? Is it 360? Is it 180? Or is it a combination? What's the typical, like, what's the structure of the business?
So we're 360. Everybody's a 360 desk. Some people here only do candidate recruiting, but that's just because they haven't evolved yet, right? So it's really more of an evolution that people aren't doing a 360. Some people evolve quicker than others. It's I don't know what it is about human nature in general, but some people are really scared about handling clients. Like, oh God, you know, that's the we all put our pants on one leg at a time. It's okay to talk to a CEO. It's no big deal. And it really amazes me how freaked out people are by that. My grandfather actually I give him credit for that, because he used to talk about, you know, calling people on the phone and talking to individuals, and he's like, what are they going to do? You know, the worst they can do is hang up on you. How bad is that? Hadn't thought about it, you know? And so anyway, eventually that's just kind of how I ultimately got into my whole mentality around sales, is that the worst they could do is hang up on you.
Quick segue, what did your grandfather do? Because this is different wisdom than I got from my grandfather.
He wasn't in sales. He was, and he was an older man. I was, my mom was born when they were older. And so he was an older man. He had already retired. And, but you know, that was, he worked for, at one point, Wilson, an oil and gas company, Wilson Industries and so forth. And that was his deal, is that, you know, what are they going to do? They're not going to hurt you. And this is back when I was, I think, 13 or 14. And, he was talking to me about it. And, you know, anyway, so it was, you know, eye-opening.
Yeah, no, for sure. Absolutely. That we could do a whole 1 hour session just on that subject, Trey, of like your self-worth and you're equal to whoever you might encounter in life, regardless of what their job title is. And, you know, what's the worst that can happen if you reach out to connect with someone and, you know, they're not interested or whatever, then, you know, is that really going to affect your day-to-day life in any way? Are you going to be any worse off for having made the attempt? Absolutely not. You've lost nothing, right? You put yourself out there. You tried something. It didn't work out. What have you lost? You've lost absolutely nothing.
Well, you've actually taken us back into the leadership and management conversation a little
bit. Okay, good. Let's go there.
I fully believe that everyone that works here has something to offer that I don't. So when I hire people, I want, you know, we all talk about diversity and inclusion, all that kind of stuff. In my mind, there's diversity in background, diversity in mindset, diversity in experience, right? That's what's diverse, right? Sometimes the color, different color means that, sometimes it doesn't, right? So I always look for diverse from an upbringing, a background, that kind of thing, so that when we all come together, we all bring different things to the table. And, you know, everyone here is just as important as I am. Yeah, sure. I'm CEO, president, owner, whatever. But, you know, someone who's only doing candidate recruiting still brings something to the table every day that I probably don't, right? They still have a skill set that I don't. And I want that skill set. I like, the only way I can get better is if I look at them as equals And you know, you can be fascinated by people. You can be, you know, amazed, but don't ever think someone's better. You know, in my mind, don't ever think someone's better than you, or in turn, worse than you, right? And that's that comes to, you know, who we are here in this company is the leaders are people who have just been able to step up and show others how to do things better, and that embrace that humility, right? There's a certain humility that comes with managing and really leadership. And I think those are two completely different things, right? Management is the day-to-day, task-oriented, have you met your numbers, right? Leading is, how do I make someone better? How, you know, because, you know, leading is, in my mind, the Pied Piper, right? Pied Piper doesn't manage rats. He just figures out a way to have them follow him out of town, right? I don't know what they're doing.
I don't think that's a good analogy, Trey, because remember, he eventually stole the children rather than the rats, right?
All right, horrible analogy. I was thinking about one instance of the concept, but oh, geez, can we delete that? The concept is you know, you can't manage people and lead them at the same time, right? You're managing a task, you're leading people, at least in my mind. And so that's what we, you know, when we're developing desks here, you can't really here, you can't manage without having both sides, right? So you've got to aspire to that 360. And then once you do that, then you can start managing, but it takes a different person to actually lead. And that, you know, someone could just be a candidate recruiter and be a good leader.
So how are you developing your leaders? Because I'm looking at your website right now on the Meet the Team page. You've got SVP, you've got SVPs, you've got VPs, you've got assistant VPs, then you've got your senior recruiters and your research analysts and stuff. So how have you cultivated and nurtured that talent to get people to assume that leadership role within the business?
I think the biggest piece is that there is no dumb question. And those who are most inquisitive tend to grow quicker than the others. So in nurturing a lot of that, it's having them manage me. The more you come to me with questions, the more you come to me with different scenarios, different ideas, different answers, the quicker you're learning. Right. It can't be a top down thing. The only top down part is, hey, you're not meeting your numbers. If you're not meeting your numbers, you're not meeting your numbers. Go meet your numbers and then we'll talk. But otherwise, it's very, integrated, right? I found this out today, and it's one of the things that kind of bums me out because we're now on a Monday, Thursday in office. Everything else is from home. And what's entertaining is I ran the numbers, a couple of months ago, and people are more effective actually at home than they are in the office as far as like just mass quantity of information or mass quantity of data. They're making more calls from home. They're just more activities going on at home. And it's because when they get here, they hadn't seen each other for a couple of days. And so they're interacting, they're talking, they're waiting until someone gets off the phone to get on the phone themselves. And, you know, so there's a lot of in between time when they're here. And so that convinced me that we're going to keep the Monday, Thursdays, or, you know, stay home the rest of the time. Rather than bringing them all back, like, you know, a lot of companies are bringing everybody back.
Yeah, that's a whole nother conversation. But I don't want to spend too much time on this topic that's been done to death. But I mean, there could be other. Do you think it could be that people want to prove that they're working when they're at home, so they're almost like over, like they're working more because they don't want anybody to think that they're just sitting there playing Xbox or something?
And again, this is a fatal flaw of mine, but I look towards the positive in everything. So, and I truly believe as human beings, we want to make an impact. We want to be positive. We want to be contributory. People are recruiters here because they want to be successful. They don't, you know, if you just have a job, then yeah, you're going to go home and you're just going to do things because you don't want someone to know that you're goofing off at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, right? Had a candidate call me one time. He couldn't believe he was fired over the phone. He was standing in line at Walmart at 2:30. I was like, that wasn't your concern. It was that you were fired while you were on the phone at Walmart and that you were at Walmart at 2:30 in the afternoon when you were supposed to be on a business development call. So, you know, there's, you know, in my mind with the people here, my least concern is that they're trying to prove themselves because they're working from home. my bigger concern is that they're more impactful, more effective. And I was actually talking to one of the individuals here about, because he lives almost walking distance from the office. I was like, why aren't you in here more? And he has a tough time with people hearing him on the phone or with hearing others on the phone. He can't dial in. I don't know. It's just his own, like we all have our own issues, right? And so for him, he's more effective at home for the sole reason that there's just nobody around. So he's able to be more impactful. The Mondays and Thursdays help him out because he can interact and maybe learn some new tools and trades, but he does more and is more effective at home because of that. So it doesn't have to do with fake it till you make it or any of that other kind of stuff that people do. I truly believe that, you know, if you look at the positive, and I'm sorry, take me go back. If I look at the positive in things, and while I can be fooled from time to time, but if I focus on the positive, it helps me understand where the training opportunities are and where the leadership opportunities are, rather than constantly worrying that someone's trying to spend my dollar on an hour of work playing Xbox.
100%. Yeah. If you've got the right people and the right culture and they're aligned with your values, then, you know, that's not something that you need to worry about. So Trey, this is awesome. Like where do you go from here? What's next for Genesis Resources and Genesis Industries?
We've got a lot of areas to grow in, but I would say the biggest focus, you know, the market's taken a little bit of a turn, you know, we all know that, but I've always, you know, whether you talk blue ocean or whatever, my goal has always been, if I could turn recruiting into being a talent agent, you know, kind of like a scout or a talent agent you've gotten baseball, football, whatever, you know, if I could turn recruiting into that where someone's got someone sitting next to them when they go in for their reviews. Now we know that's not going to happen, but we have so much knowledge and information as recruiters that we can provide the marketplace. And marketplace, I mean, those people who are not hiring, but who are, maybe they are hiring as well, but who are going in for their reviews. They're going in for, maybe they're interviewing another candidate, right? For something. If we can provide that information and give them the ability to be better, you know, the more excited I am about the market. I had this, I'll be brief, but I had this one example, and this kind of leads to the next conversation, the next piece. But I had this one individual who referred me to her sister who was looking to leave a company after 15 years. And I was like, oh my God, you're leaving this company. Well, the company's global, and she was working in the domestic department of compliance. And within insurance, you know, that's a big deal, but she had all this international experience that she wasn't able to use. And so she was underpaid and she just had to go. She was time to leave. Her manager wasn't utilizing her well and so forth. I kind of walked her through it and we coached her through that. And after about, and how to apply internally, cause she was worried she was going to get fired if her boss found out she was applying to other jobs internally and, you know, all these things that go through people's heads. And ultimately helped her get a job with their international division. And it wasn't, you know, huge dollars, but for her it was. She went from making, I think it was $65,000 or $70,000 a year to making $95,000 a year.
Wow.
And got to keep her 15 years of tenure. Right. And now I didn't make a dime on it. Right. So it wasn't about the dollars. It was about just helping someone understand where they were. And I truly believe at the end of the day, if we can do that with more people, we're making, not only making a difference, but those people are going to want to call us back when we call them, which actually benefits our clients. So when I talk to a new company about using us, they go, what makes you different from the other recruiters? I said, people actually call me back. And they have to think about it for a minute. Well, what do you mean they call you back? I said, well, they want to talk to me because I've already helped them somewhere else in their career. I've helped one of their friends. They know that when they call me, it's not just about you, Mr. Client. It's about their career. And so they're always going to call me back because it's about their career and the betterment of them, not just to fill this one job and make a buck. And that's why you should use me, is because I'm going to get everyone that doesn't call people back to call me back, which gives you access to that talent.
Great answer. And that's a perfect way to end this particular episode, Trey. I really enjoyed that. Thanks for being on The Resilient Recruiter.
Thank you.
Thanks for watching. If you enjoyed this conversation, check out some of my other episodes. You'll see one or two suggested episodes on the screen now.